You're listening to Insight Live on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sometimes we have very young listeners, so at this moment, I want to give a warning about the conversation I'm going to have with writer Rachel Howard. Her debut novel, titled The Risk of Us, is about a young couple and their adoption process. But while we're talking about this new novel, we are going to talk a bit about her memoir from 2005, titled The Lost Night. And it details Rachel's real-life experience when she was 10. Her dad was killed. It was an unsolved murder, and she was trying to piece together what happened. So again, I ask you to please use discretion in who might be listening right now to this conversation. And I'm happy to have Rachel Howard with me in the studio. It's lovely to meet you, and I really am enjoying your work. Thanks for being here.
I'm so grateful to you for having me.
So at age 10, the murder happened. How old were you then when you could actually see this as a thing, a childhood trauma that had happened in your life and would forever frame and in some ways define who you were?
Yeah, and it happened in our own house when I was there, and I came out and saw blood up and down the hallway and saw my dad carried out. Immediately after, I wasn't able to be with it because I had to go live with an abusive stepfather back at home. And I was given some Valium, and I wasn't really ready to talk, so not much processing beyond that. Then when a romantic relationships come into a person's life, that starts to bring all of this up with losing a father in a shocking way. So I think at about 18, I actually started secretly trying to write about it. And then I, at college, started having a breakdown, and I knew that was at the root.
When you finally wrote about it, and that was the process of trying to confront it and piece together what had happened, what did you get back in terms of sharing your story across the country? What came back to you?
I don't really know, actually. I mean, I do hear from a lot of people who have lost their own parents who have been moved by the book, and it's given them the strength to face it. I do still, even now, more than a decade later, get emails from people having that response. And also just, I think, feeling that they don't have to go around thinking that they're freaks. Someone else has gone through this and is moving on, not necessarily moving on. I mean, I don't want to say that it's you move on. It's always part of your life, but instead of being a negative story about yourself, it can become a positive one if you move through it and it becomes something that you faced.
You talked with Ira Glass for a segment in an episode of This American Life, and I really learned something from that about the sensitivity and the awareness in how someone sees and hears the world based on a traumatic experience. And I'd like to share a clip from that show. It was in 2007. The theme was Rest in Peace. And the two of you were talking about how the subject of murder or death is handled in popular culture. Are you okay if I share a clip from that segment?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's listen. Here's Ira Glass.
You know how murder figures into so much of American pop culture on crime shows and thrillers and video games and all kinds of stuff? Well, if you knew somebody who actually got murdered, turns out you might not be into that stuff so much.
I can't watch Law and Order. Not going to watch Law and Order or play Clue or, you know, go to a murder mystery dinner theater.
Rachel Howard's dad was killed when she was 10. And as an adult, she's met a lot of people whose family members were killed. Now, she says that some of them love shows like CSI and Murder, She Wrote, any kind of murder show. Officially, organizations like the group Parents of Murdered Children take a stand against murder as entertainment.
So they do. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's interesting that you bring that up again, because actually in my Facebook feed a couple of days ago, the new trend, there's this advertisement for Have a Date Night In, and it's a Solve a Murder kit. So it's still coming up in the culture a lot.
Do you still react to it the same way? So this is now 12 years later. Where are you now with all of this? And I do want to say that even as you were recounting what happened when you were 10, I could see the emotion in your face and in your eyes. It comes up pretty evidently.
Yeah, definitely. I'd still choose. I mean, I'm not going to play Murder Mystery Night game with my husband. At the same time, I don't feel angry towards people who are engaging in that kind of entertainment. I understand that they didn't have the experiences that I did. And so I'm not going to blame them for ignorance. But, you know, if it happened to them, they probably wouldn't be playing that. So I don't think I go into like a place of shock or like panicked avoidance, but it's still not something I'm going to choose to do. And yeah, for the way that the emotion comes back, I mean, there are definitely moments where I can still come back into that reality of that night and also not knowing what happened. We don't know who killed him, and am I ever going to know? And I can sink into that and be in that emotional place. But what happens after you write a book about trauma? I'm also realizing that I did a lot of different things. So like once I finished the book, I really felt that I was profoundly in a different story of my life. And that part of my life was contained within the book covers and I could go back there, but I didn't have to every day relive it. But I did some other things like I became very influenced by a certain strain of Christianity that's big on paradox and religion. That kind of religion became important to me. I was very formed at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And I also started doing a lot of reading in Buddhism and meditation groups. So there were all these kinds of practices that kind of teach you to stay with painful things in a calm way. And so when the feeling comes up, I don't necessarily feel threatened by it, though. I can just be with the feeling.
I'm going to use that as a segue to this novel you wrote, The Risk of Us. There's a 7-year-old girl in the story who is in the foster system. We don't know all the details of the trauma that she experienced. It informs the story, though. And to me, you treat her trauma almost as a character.
Mm.
It kind of becomes this entity that plays throughout, and when it acts up, everything's all in capital letters, and it is the person that's there. And even though you have said the memoir didn't influence heavily the story, you are there in the character of the mom, and the trauma is there in the character of the little girl.
Yeah, definitely. So the impetus for the two books was very different because with the memoir, it was about me. I needed to write that story to unearth things, understand my life, and investigate myself. And with this book, there was a point of entry of being in the foster care system and seeing how emotionally complex it was and how one moment could be really difficult and painful, and the next moment could be really surprising and beautiful. And moving between this panic of how can we help this little girl and then having a breakthrough, and those things stand side by side. And so the impetus there was not to understand myself. The story was like, in a weird way, profoundly not about me, but just to investigate that kind of crucible of these three people trying to help each other.
Let me point out that the couple in the story is trying to, or hoping to, exploring whether to adopt Marisa, mm-hmm. a little 7-year-old. You are an adoptive parent yourself. Did the title of this book come from a brochure that you actually saw?
Yeah, it did. So one of the first lines is the brochure at the Foster Services Agency asks for families that take risks. And that is a brochure that I saw, and that was part of the catalyst for the book, because I thought, you know, usually you're advertised for parents who are stable and secure and loving, but why would you want parents who take risks? That seemed to be saying something in a coded way about what the situation is really like. And then coming back to the trauma, though, I'm glad you brought that up, because the point of my life that I decided to keep in the novel, even though it's a novel, is this woman, the narrator, who's speaking the story to the 7-year-old girl and her husband, having a childhood murder in her own background. Mm-hmm. Because to me, as a fictional element, she's coming in feeling like she has this point of empathy. And I love that you're saying that the trauma is almost its own character in the book, because she does. She feels like, well, I'm going to understand what's going on. I can remember having those kinds of panic attacks myself, and that's going to help me break through and do this kind of parenting. And then that really gets put to the test. Does that empathy, is that enough? If you can understand what the person is going through still, how do you break through? And then the mother who's trying to adopt also has these moments of being brought to a deep humility, because she realizes even what she went through may not be as bad as what this little girl has gone through.
You're listening to Nevada City author Rachel Howard. Her debut novel is The Risk of Us. I am going to ask you to read from the book, but let's go to election night.
Okay.
Let's go to the segment of the book when there had been a family gathering. There was going to be a meeting with a therapist. I don't know if you want to set it up anymore.
I think that's great. We drive to Grandma Annie and Papa's for Thanksgiving. Your uncle and aunt and your cousins meet us there. You scream a lot at bedtime, refuse to take baths or brush teeth. Your uncle and aunt and their kids stay outside in a motorhome while we stay in the house's guest room, and your uncle and I have some good midnight chats. Not the smoothest of holidays, no, but to be honest, I hardly remember it. What I do remember from that November is our first session with the new therapist, the one out in the country with the four-legged assistants. How you fed the dappled gelding and the bay mare, petted the cat, played tug-of-war with the chihuahua. How the new therapist said anything you shared there could be your secret, and how, when you didn't believe her, she pointed to the horizon and said, "No one can hear us out here, so go ahead, Marisa, scream." And your scream echoed over the rolling hills. But there was something new in it, something like freedom. When the session was finished, the therapist held the dog's paw and waved by and said, "We're all very pleased to meet you, Marisa, and I'd say we're off to a great start." Daddy drove and I sat in the front seat on the way home, you in the back. The long stretch from the dirt road to the twisty paved one. We strained to hear the voices on the radio filling airtime, waiting for the election returns. The oak leaves yellow, the maple leaves red, the sunset burning a shade I'd call hope. "Our first woman president," Daddy said. "Shh," I said, "don't jinx it." But I was smiling. You from the back seat. "So they're not going to build a wall?"
Set on election night.
Mm-hmm.
I have said that the book is startling because you take us through some very rough terrain. You also take us into love, and it raised the question for me, could love be enough? Do you think love can be enough?
And that's a big topic in the foster care world. And part of the reason I wanted to explore this here in a way that I think fiction can do, that nonfiction can't always, because in fiction, it's about these characters. And so judgment can be suspended. And you can try to have empathy for everyone. And it doesn't have to appeal to what is in the quote unquote real world. You're just in this protected space of exploring without judgment. But yeah, people in the foster care system, you know, they speak passionately in both ways. Love is ultimately what heals a person. And you don't know. Sometimes you can love with all your heart and not get the outcome you hope for.
The new Surgeon General, the first Surgeon General of California, wants to focus on childhood trauma as an important area for research, for screening, for assistance. How do those words sound to you?
I think that would be fabulous. I think what is needed, I recommend at the end of the book, I put some footnotes on the actual parenting books that I quote, even though it's fiction within the book. And one of them is Besser Randall Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. And I can't recommend it highly enough. And one thing that's interesting that he points to, so first off, the two most dependably traumatized populations are veterans and children in foster care. Mm. And the thing that he really finds through MRI studies and empirical research that helps people is singing, art, theater, playing. You know, sometimes the work that happens it doesn't happen like in the book, the cinder block building, the institutional building that they have to go to see the first therapist. Tremendous healing happens through art. So I hope that they'll keep investigating those ways of healing too.
Where can people see you real quickly? Do you have anything coming up in the area?
Yeah, so I'll be at Time Tested Books in Sacramento tomorrow night, Thursday at 7.
Okay. We'll post more online, including the This American Life episode and links to your website. Rachel, it's a delight to meet you. I look forward to working together with you again.
Thank you so much.
That is Rachel Howard. Her debut novel is The Risk of Us. Her memoir from 2005 is titled The Lost Night. There's more at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Our producers are Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, and Kate Gonzalez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer, Antonio Munoz. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.